seeing a trend here where half the victims are under the age of 21. I mean, this is really concerning.
Assessing the uptick in crime in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the new DNR commissioner, Andy Mack, settles into his new job with a focus on one thing.
Without Arctic development, the state of Alaska will probably struggle.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Today is primary election day. In addition to the regular polling locations, you can also vote at the airport in six Alaska communities, Ted Stevens International in Anchorage, Fairbanks International, Juneau, Sitka, Ketchikan, and Kodiak. Each airport location has ballots for all 40 of Alaska's election districts. The polls are open until 8 p.m. tonight. Anchorage is having one of its most violent years in decades. 22 people have been killed, along with two more deaths from officer-involved shootings. In July alone, there were 9 homicides within the municipality. This comes just after 2015 saw the highest number of murders since the mid-90s and has many residents asking whether something's changed that has made the city more dangerous. To find out, Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes sat down with the head of the Anchorage Police Department.
Chief Chris Tolley and I sit down for a long interview on the 8th floor of City Hall, and he quickly comes out with a sentiment that's fairly common in Anchorage right now.
There's no doubt about it, Zach. Right now, we're having a lot of crimes, and I'm concerned, and I know the community's concerned.
The department tracks a lot of data and is seeing a 15% increase in calls for service. That includes everything from assaults to property theft to reports of suspicious activity. Just the overall volume, Tolley says, that's up. But what's got most people's attention is what seems like a lot more violent crime. Shootings, stabbings, and a rash of murders, a dozen of them clustered around just 6 weeks this summer.
We're seeing a trend here where half the victims are under the age of 21. I mean, this is really concerning that our juveniles and young adults or in a vulnerable area.
Tolley is quick to point out that there's no one cause that explains all of this year's homicides. He says the department's found no compelling evidence the murders are linked to gang activity. Nearly a third of the murders relate to domestic violence. Mental health problems have played a prominent role in some of the cases. Tolley says the most consistent factor is the presence of drugs and alcohol.
Most of these incidents are things that went too far. Disputes over different things, over drugs or things like that. It's incidents that have gone too far. Domestic violence is another big part of this. You know, it's really concerning. So do you know somebody's having struggling in your family or your neighbor that some intervention may be necessary?
Across the municipality, neighborhood crime watches post information to Facebook groups, not all of it verified. And there are more and more citizens that have signed up to get crime alerts sent straight to their phones. And with so much data pouring in, it can be easy to feel like chaos is descending. Tolley and other city officials want you to resist that impulse, though. Over the last decade, the homicide rate has fluctuated between about 4 and 8 deaths per 100,000 residents. If this year ends with no more murders, which is unlikely, the rate would be about 8. By contrast, the murder rate in St. Louis last year was 59. Tolley calls a violent year like this in Anchorage a fluke, but says it's neither unprecedented nor an anomaly.
Over the 8- and 10-year trends, you do see spikes like this historically and so on. Is this one of those spikes? Probably was. we have to wait to see what the rest of the year brings us.
In response to the violence, particularly among young people, the department plans on using more school resource officers, the police who are permanently stationed within schools once classes resume. Tali also says that as staffing levels rise, the department is reevaluating policies and procedures to improve them and trying to develop better lines of communication with communities. But he says often police get called in the aftermath of violence, and there's a limit to what they can be expected to do.
This isn't about the police department solely. It's about our community. I'm as concerned as the rest of the community is. I can't fix this by myself. The administration can't fix it by itself. It takes the community to take ownership of this. Police are not a substitution for health services. Police are not a substitution for school teachers, for that matter, as parents.
That's a view shared by Mayor Ethan Berkowitz's administration as well. They've prioritized restoring police staffing levels, which were reduced under the previous administration. And Berkowitz says they're beginning to see progress.
The police force has grown substantially over the last year. We're almost at 400 officers now, which was the goal.
Berkowitz believes that more police is the starting point for better public safety because the extra capacity means officers can be more proactive and less reactive. Like Tali, he sees violent crime as more complex than any one cause. However, he says problems are being exacerbated by shrinking state support in areas that overlap with violent crime, like reduced drug and alcohol treatment options and release of prisoners from correctional facilities. But Berkowitz is adamant that even amid recent upticks, Anchorage is still a relatively safe city.
The idea that you can have a totally safe community is something we aspire to, but it's not going to happen.
Another view Berkowitz and Tali share is that violent crime is concentrated around the drug trade and what the mayor calls bad lifestyle choices. The other side of the administration's approach to community policing has been trying to rebuild community partnerships.
The community also has a responsibility to help the police do their job and help the police do their job in a way that's safer.
If our community is not involved in providing the solutions, then we're already missing the piece.
Mao Tosi is a community advocate in Anchorage and was deeply involved in the city's anti-gang efforts several years ago. His diagnosis of the escalation in violent crime is that it began when social services and opportunities to low-income communities started to be reduced under the last mayoral administration. And those cuts to services and staff, Tosi says, haven't yet been recouped.
So we have less police officers. And even in our school districts, they're cutting funds in our education. So we have less teachers, less programming. So all these things are almost the perfect storm of issues coming together.
Tosi says he supports the administration's efforts to pursue a better community policing model, but that after several years of worsening relations, the gap has widened between APD and the communities experiencing the heaviest toll from violent crime. Communication is great, but Tosi says so far, policy has come from the top floor of City Hall without enough input from those closest to what's happening on the street. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Ketchikan Regional Youth Facility, a detention center for juvenile offenders, will close September 15th. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services announced yesterday the closure will mean the loss of 15 jobs, and Ketchikan area youth who require detention now will be sent to Juneau. Ketchikan's youth facility was built in 2002 and was strongly endorsed by local officials as a way to keep youthful offenders closer to their families. It was built to hold up to 10 juveniles. Rob Wood, director of the state's Division of Juvenile Justice, says the Ketchikan facility has been underutilized in recent years, with an average of 4 youth housed there at a time.
We actually started looking at the possibility of reprogramming the facility about 4 years ago, just on the possibility we could find a way to make the utilization better and fill a need.
That didn't work out, though, and Wood says the facility costs about $2 million a year to operate. That's because it has to be ready for full capacity, even when it's at less than half most of the time.
That was an expense that, as the state budget became more fragile over the last year and a half, since we couldn't find a better use or a more complete use for the facility, we had to look at a decision to close.
Wood says delinquency rates are down across the country, including Alaska. When that happens, smaller facilities like Ketchikan's are vulnerable to closure. He says, however, lower delinquency rates are a good thing.
I keep telling people that, the division's not in the business to be self-sustaining. The division's in the business of doing good things for kids and families and the state. And if we have less work to do, that is kind of a good thing, even though it's a scary thing.
The youth in the facility, their families, local officials, and staff were told about the closure last week. As of Monday, Wood says there are 6 youth in the Ketchikan facility. 15 full-time employees received layoff notices, and one facility position will be reassigned to Ketchikan's juvenile probation office. The Ketchikan Regional Youth Facility was built on City of Ketchikan-owned property. Wood says under the terms of the lease agreement, the property reverts back to the city when the state vacates the facility. Wood says the state has looked at other small youth facilities in Alaska to determine their feasibility and whether they could be privatized to save the state money. So far, Ketchikan's is the only one slated for closure. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a lesson on LGBTQ history in Anchorage.
Well, when that tear gas bomb went off, everyone thought it was part of an entrance.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Tonight, the cruise ship Crystal Serenity will cast off from Seward for a first-of-its-kind trip through the Arctic's Northwest Passage to New York City. It's the first luxury liner to attempt the route and the largest passenger ship by far. Many people are wondering if it's a sign of what's to come as the Arctic sees increasingly ice-free summers. Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk is in Seward. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Lori.
Rachel, remind us why this is a big deal. There's been a lot of attention to it nationally, internationally. Why is it a big deal?
Yeah, well, it's a big deal because it's a big ship, basically. It's going to be more than 1,600 people. That's more than 1,000 passengers and more than 600 crew. And so a ship of that kind just hasn't attempted to cross through the Arctic before. And it's in a region that, you know, because it hasn't seen anything remotely on this scale before, it's not clear that the region is prepared for that. There isn't the kind of infrastructure. There isn't the kind of search and rescue capabilities. The towns that will be visited haven't seen this kind of tourism on this scale. And cruise companies haven't proven yet that they can handle the Arctic. And so this is really the first test. And to that end, it's actually been a real wake-up call for authorities. So the U.S. Coast Guard and the military will be conducting a joint exercise with Canadian forces in the Bering Strait next week, in which they simulate rescuing 250 passengers from a cruise ship. And it'll be happening just as the Crystal Serenity is passing through the region.
Have you been able to get aboard the ship? What's it like?
Well, I haven't been able to get on yet. I have a tour scheduled for 3 p.m., and I'm really excited because it's supposed to be just super top-end, luxe cruise ship. A basic stateroom for this trip was sold for more than $20,000, and the highest-end penthouse, which comes with personal butler service, listed at more than $120,000. So this is really a very high-end cruise. There's as many as 8 restaurants. There's a casino. There's a dance club. There's a spa. There's designer boutiques. And, you know, that's probably good because it's actually a very long trip without that many stops along the way. It's going to take more than a month to get from Seward to New York City. And along the way, there are stops in Kodiak, Unalaska, Nome, a couple places in Canada and Greenland, but actually quite a bit of just cruising.
All right. So if it's really nice, don't stow away and try to take off with them.
I know, right? If they offer me a trip, Lori, I'm going.
All right. Well, thanks, Rachel, for that update from Seward.
Thanks, Lori.
That's Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk speaking from Seward. The Crystal Serenity is scheduled to leave Seward tonight and will be stopping in Kodiak tomorrow, in Unalaska on Friday, and in Nome on Sunday. A petition signed by 150 Alaskans sent to Governor Bill Walker asks for changes to state predator control programs. The letter sent yesterday asks the governor to replace lethal predator control methods with non-lethal techniques, to terminate use of radio collars to locate and kill wolves, and to prohibit intensive management programs within 5 miles of federal conservation lands like national parks. According to petitioner, wildlife advocate, and biologist Rick Steiner of Anchorage, signers hail from 28 Alaska communities and include former Alaska Board of Game members and a former Fish and Game Commissioner. From Soldotna to the North Slope to Anchorage, the state's newest Natural Resources Commissioner has spent his career weighing in on energy issues all over the state. Now, Andy Mack has been tapped by Governor Bill Walker to help guide the state through the maze of federal regulations required to develop oil and gas resources. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
Andy Mack has been both a civil and criminal defense attorney. He was a legislative aide for a decade, and most recently managed a private investment firm. But he's probably best known for his time spent working on the North Slope. And the new DNR commissioner says all eyes should be on the Arctic.
Without Arctic development, the state of Alaska will probably struggle.
But nothing in the Arctic is easy. And the technical challenge for oil companies mirrors the tricky process of navigating tribal, state, and federal land ownership. Mack has plenty of experience wading through the complex regulatory process of opening up federal land for public and private use. Mack spent 5 years working as an advisor to the North Slope Borough during a renaissance in exploration and development in the Arctic Ocean. Mack says he spent a lot of his time at the borough weighing in on development on federal land, like the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, and the Outer Continental Shelf.
I think the challenge for Alaska is how to approach areas where we historically have not had access, or the access is controlled by the federal government. And I think, part of my experience lends itself very well to ensuring that we can generate access.
Key to that access, Mack says, is whether local communities, like Barrow, support going into areas that are managed by the federal government. He says the communities have to balance development and subsistence. Mack's experience gaining access to federal lands and building contacts across the state is one of the main reasons Governor Walker says he hired him.
The maze that that we need to get through, that he has worked his capacity as an attorney and as a consultant for a number of organizations in Alaska that have been in permitting processes with the federal government on oil and gas development and beyond.
Mack has joined Walker's oil and gas team at a contentious time. The state is battling with BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil over the details of how the companies will sell natural gas from Prudhoe Bay. When the producers declined to turn over specific marketing information, Walker refused to sign the annual development plan for the field. It's unclear what would come of the state threatening the company's leases if they refuse to give in, but Prudhoe Bay was responsible for nearly half of the state's oil production last year. The decision to pursue marketing information predates Mack's time at DNR. He says he supports the process, but wasn't ready to weigh in on whether the state would revoke the leases at Prudhoe Bay.
We're in a process, so I'm not going to answer.
Mack also supports another of the governor's controversial decisions. This year, Walker vetoed about $430 million in tax credit payments owed to oil companies.
It's very important that as Alaskans, we appreciate what the world markets think of Alaska, that we're able to attract investment capital, and that we're able to recycle some of the money that we have available to us here in Alaska.
Looking ahead, Mack says he's focused on protecting the state's interests and encouraging investment in the state's resources at a time when budget challenges make it seem risky. Mack will also be spending a lot of time working on the state's response to the Department of Interior's 5-year plans for offshore oil and gas leases. Right now, those plans include 3 potential lease sales in Alaska, 2 in the Arctic and 1 in Cook Inlet. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast offers online degree courses featuring practitioner-oriented instruction with a focus on skills for direct career application. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
The Coast Guard has stopped looking for a man missing since Sunday. Authorities believe Arnold Skeek, a 27-year-old fisherman from Cake, fell into Auk Bay from the 60-foot fishing tender, the Beaufort Sea. KTOO's Quinton Chandler reports Skeek's family presumes he is dead.
The search was suspended early Monday afternoon. Arnold Skeek's sister, Amy Meets, describes how the news of her brother's disappearance reached the family.
His captain had called my dad, who I was visiting, and he was crying, very distraught, saying, "I can't find Arnold anywhere." You know, he said that at 6 o'clock in the morning, he saw Arnold sleeping in the galley, and at 10 o'clock in the morning, when everyone woke up, he was gone.
On Sunday, the Coast Guard had reported that Skeek was sleeping on deck. Monday, a spokesperson could not be reached to address the discrepancy. The Coast Guard said they started searching around 11 a.m. Authorities believe Skeek most likely fell overboard. They said the ship was likely anchored too far from shore for him to get back on his own. Meets agrees. All the signs suggest he'd gone over.
I know for a fact if he was anywhere, he would have taken his phone, if nothing else, but absolutely everything was left on board, and right then and there I knew he was gone.
Meets says her brother loved being a fisherman, and he was happy he was following in the footsteps of his father and grandfather. She says he was a generous person, never unwilling to help his family, and his disappearance is one more tragedy to add to the list.
No, our mother passed away last year and our grandma passed away this year. It's been rough. Now Arnold's gone.
Meets says her brother was also her father's caretaker. Her father is disabled and has very fragile health. Meets says he is taking the news especially hard.
He was hyperventilating. He went into my brother's room. You know, and after that, he just fell to his knees and he couldn't stop crying, and then it was hard for him to breathe.
The Coast Guard searched for Skeek for more than 26 hours. Meets says her family is grateful for everyone who helped look for her brother, including a number of local Good Samaritans. Skeek is leaving behind 5 siblings, his father, and an 8-year-old son, who Meets says is waiting for closure. In Juneau, I'm Quinton Chandler.
During the rowdy pipeline construction days, bars lined 4th Avenue in downtown Anchorage. Many of those establishments were surprisingly open to gay and lesbian Alaskans. On a bus tour this summer, Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman learned about the role those establishments played in local LGBTQ history.
Myrna LaCroix stands at the front of a bus with a bullhorn, pointing out the locations of old Anchorage bars.
It was so sleazy. It was so much fun.
The passengers giggle at body jokes and memories from 30 and 40 years ago, when bar culture was huge in Anchorage. They're on a tour of historical gay hotspots. Myrna points to the original Rendezvous Club in downtown.
We had a lot of fun in that little place. It would hold 40 and we had 80 in it.
That was on the bottom half.
Yeah, right.
Another tour leader, Russ Reno, jumps into the conversation. The tour focuses on the high points of gay life in the 1970s and 80s, the fun places to drink and do drugs. But Reno points out that there was a reason for the culture of escapism in the 1980s, the AIDS epidemic.
How many people have at least five people on this bus that they know and consider friends? Okay, now I want you to imagine for a second, without being too depressing here, think about what you'd feel like after just maybe 2 years or 3 years and losing just about every single one of those friends and maybe having yourself and one other left. And that was what the 80s were all about.
Reno says he gathered with others in bars because they were safe spaces and they could party away their sadness. He says that before AIDS, it was easier to be gay in Alaska. People didn't care as much about your sexual identity. They had the Gay Olympics and gay social organizations like the Mount McKinley Non-Ascent Club.
We never went up, but we've been known to, well, you know the rest of that. So it was a gentleman's club.
He says the small LGBT community even had political clout because just a few votes could change anything.
And we could organize relatively quickly. So we'd get people out there to vote and we could learn that we could push the election in the direction we wanted it to go. So we became very political back in the day.
But Reno says after the AIDS epidemic started, the general community and religious leaders became more homophobic. Madeline Holdorf was at an annual celebration for the LGBT community and drag performers in 1982 when someone threw tear gas into the room.
Well, when that tear gas bomb went off, everyone thought it was part of an entrance or part of the show. And in fact, it was tear gas that went off in the ballroom. I was on the dais, which is, you know, the main stage, and everyone in the room moved at the same time.
Despite the tear gas incident, Holdorf says for years, hundreds of people would turn out for the event. She says part of the reason was that unlike in other parts of the U.S., gay men and lesbians hung out together. They didn't have things like separate bars. But now that the greater community is more accepting of LGBT people, the crowds at those events are much smaller. Holdorf says you don't have to be into bars or drag shows to find other gay people anymore. One of the bus tour organizers, Nicole Cundiff with Alaskans Together for Equality, says that doesn't mean that the LGBT community has achieved equal rights.
We have national marriage equality, and we have some non-discrimination ordinances in the state, but statewide, we still don't have LGBT protections, especially when it comes to our transgender population.
Cundiff says that's part of the reason why they organized the tour, so people would remember the city's history and stay motivated to keep pushing for equal protections. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Rachel Waldholtz in Seward, Quinton Chandler and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.